Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you own an apartment, maybe a townhouse, or, you know, any property under a shared management scheme, you are part of the huge, complex world of strata.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we are wading into the Australian strata management industry.
Mm.
It's a sector that's really trying, or at least saying it's trying, to become a proper profession.
Right. Moving from just an occupation to a profession.
Exactly. But we've taken a deep dive into some pretty serious research that shows this one giant systemic, deeply embedded obstacle standing right in the way.
And that obstacle is institutionalized conflicts of interest.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, this is a really critical look at how the basic business models, the very way strata management companies make money, are often inherently designed to generate conflict.
And the sources we're looking at, they aren't just anecdotes, are they?
No, no, not at all. This is based on a really comprehensive qualitative mixed methods report. We're talking analysis of like 153 strata management websites, 35 actual agreements, interviews with 20 senior managers, plus focus groups with 16 strata owners.
Wow. Okay. So pretty thorough.
Very thorough. And this whole diagnosis, it really kicked off after some intense media scrutiny back in 2024.
And the mission here was crucial, wasn't it? To really pinpoint those specific practices, the ones that put the manager's wallet ahead of the client's actual interests.
Exactly. And to see why current rules, the regulations have just failed to stop it. And importantly, to understand the real-world impact this has on you, the strata lot owner.
Right, the person paying the fees.
Precisely. And the core finding, the thing that kind of frames this whole discussion, is pretty devastating for regulators.
Which is?
That the main regulatory tool they've always relied on, disclosure, is shown to be completely ineffective. Just telling people about the conflict doesn't solve it.
So it just creates what the report called an illusion of transparency.
That's a term, yeah, an illusion. Which, predictably, leads to this widespread and, frankly, justified distrust among owners.
Illusion of transparency. That really hits hard. It suggests the system thinks it's fix it, but it's actually just sort of hiding the problem better.
Mm-hmm.
But before we dive into why disclosure fails so badly, we need to look at the history. I mean, is this a new problem? Did it just pop up?
Oh, far from it. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the COI risks, they've plagued the industry for, well, over three decades. Seriously.
Three decades.
Yeah, the sources point to exposés going way back to 1992. There was this Alliance Strata Management case where owners actually uncovered undisclosed commissions and affiliated in-house companies being used.
So this isn't new at all. It's been baked in for a long time. Were people warning about this earlier on?
Oh, absolutely. Legal experts like Gary Bugden were really sounding the alarm back in 2008 and then again in 2021.
What was he saying?
He was cautioning managers, basically saying, look, you need to dramatically cut these outside revenue streams, these commissions and things, and instead charge more transparent base fees if you ever want to be seen as true professionals.
And that advice was?
Pretty much ignored consistently.
Okay. So why is strata management itself, structurally speaking, such a high-risk area for these conflicts? What makes it so vulnerable?
Well, the structure is kind of the problem, isn't it? Strata properties, they're legally complex. Very complex.
Right.
And management usually relies on volunteer committee members. Nice people doing their best, but they often lack the technical know-how in things like insurance or engineering or complex legal stuff.
Which creates this intense reliance on the manager.
Exactly. An agency relationship where owners basically have to trust the manager implicitly. And that vulnerability, that gap in expertise, it creates opportunities for a manager to perhaps unconsciously or consciously put their own financial interests first.
Which brings us back to the definition of a conflict of interest. It's not just about proving someone did the wrong thing, is it?
Absolutely not. The threshold for a conflict is actually incredibly low.
Yeah.
A conflict is simply a situation where an interest, usually financial, tempts someone to disregard their duty to their client.
Just being tempted is enough.
Just being tempted. That potential threat to the client's interest is sufficient to constitute the conflict. Even if the manager genuinely believes they're acting ethically, the temptation itself is the issue.
Okay, that concept, just being tempted, is key. And it leads us straight into how that temptation is actually built into their monthly income.
Right.
So let's stop talking theory. Let's look at the actual business mechanics funding that temptation. What are the big four pillars of conflicted revenue the report identified?
Okay, pillar number one, and this is often the bedrock of the traditional business model, insurance commission dependencies.
insurance commissions. How big a deal is this? Is it just a little extra on the side, or is it like fundamental to keeping the lights on for some firm?
Oh, it's often the latter. It's fundamental. Managers get commissions from insurance brokers, sometimes directly from insurers, and these typically range from 9% up to, honestly, a staggering 25% of the base premium.
25%? Wow.
Yeah. So for many traditional strata managers, this isn't bonus cash. It can make up 15% to 25% of their total company revenue and a huge chunk of their actual profit.
That's just a massive incentive, isn't it? To maybe choose the insurance that pays them the most, not necessarily the one that's best value for the owner's corporation.
Precisely. But the report flagged an even deeper, more insidious issue here, something called cross-subsidization.
Cross-subsidization. Okay, explain that.
So this is the real conflict nugget. That commission money they earn, especially from large schemes with high premiums, it's often used to subsidize the base management fees across their entire portfolio of clients.
Wait, so say you're in a small, well-maintained building with low insurance costs.
Yep.
You're actually being subsidized by the massive building next door that maybe has huge defect issues and therefore sky-high insurance premiums.
That's exactly it. The building with the biggest problems, the one already under huge financial stress, is effectively paying more to cover the manager's operating costs for all the other, perhaps less problematic, schemes in that manager's portfolio.
That just seems fundamentally unfair. A totally distorted pricing model. I can see why owners reported feeling shocked and, well, pretty angry when they found out.
Yeah, the report quoted one owner group saying they felt unfairly embroiled in a remuneration model that was significantly disadvantageous at a time where they were under enormous financial constraint. It really hits them when they're already struggling.
Okay, let's move to the second pillar, developer consulting arrangements. How does the conflict start here?
This one starts right at the very beginning, day one, even before the building is registered sometimes. Managers will do free work or heavily discounted work for property developers.
Like what kind of work?
Setting up the initial budgets, preparing the paperwork needed to get the strata scheme registered, all that pre-setup stuff.
And in return for this free or cheap work?
In exchange, they basically secure two things. First, they get locked in as the initial managing agent, usually until the first AGM when owners can theoretically change. Second, they get access to guaranteed fee income, like the fees for issuing Section 184 certificates.
Okay, you mentioned the Section 184 certificate. For those of us not deep in strata law, what is that and why is it valuable for the manager?
Right, so it's basically a mandatory disclosure statement. When someone's buying a strata unit, they need this certificate. It details the financial health, the levies, any known issues, the insurance details of the owner's corporation.
Essential info for a buyer.
Absolutely essential. Wow. And the strata manager is usually the only one who can issue it. And they charge a fee every single time one is needed for a sale. So getting that initial appointment gives them immediate access to this easy, guaranteed revenue stream from all the initial sales and then ongoing sales.
Okay, so that whole arrangement puts the manager in an impossible position right away, doesn't it? The report said they cannot serve two masters.
Exactly. Their first loyalty, effectively, is to the developer who gave them the gig. Mm-hmm. And that developer might pressure them, maybe subtly, maybe not so subtly, to lowball the initial levies.
To make the apartments look cheaper to buy and run.
Precisely. Make the ongoing costs look more attractive to potential buyers. But that often means the scheme is underfunded from the start.
And it's not just levies, is it? The manager might advise the developer on other things.
Correct. They might advise on setting up bylaws that benefit the developer long term, like giving them special leasing rights over parts of the common property or structuring things in a way that maintains developer control. Advice that's good for the developer, but potentially really detrimental to the future owner's corporation that manager is supposed to represent.
So compromise from day one. Okay, third pillar. Vertical integration and affiliated entities. We see this in lots of industries, big companies owning related businesses. How does it create conflict specifically in strata?
Well, as strata management firms grow, especially the larger ones, they often set up or buy related businesses. So you'll have the management company owning its own in-house insurance broking arm or maintenance division, maybe legal services, even debt collection.
And the manager then steers the strata scheme's business towards these in-house companies.
That's the incentive.
Yeah. Now, technically, this relationship has to be disclosed, right? But the report found the disclosure is often lacking.
Lacking is a good word. Often buried in the fine print of the management agreement, using really vague terms like related party or subsidiary without clearly explaining the financial flow.
Okay.
And the source material is really clear here. The manager's associated entity, their sister company, benefits financially directly from the manager's portfolio of captive clients.
Which completely undermines getting competitive quotes for services.
Totally. The manager gets to see all the quotes coming in from external contractors. They have this privileged inside knowledge. They can then ensure their own affiliated company just undercuts the competition slightly,
yeah,
or matches the best, quote, guaranteeing they win the business.
Regardless of whether it's actually the best quality service or the best long-term value for the owners.
Exactly. And owners in the study reported feeling real pressure, sometimes quite intense pressure, to use those affiliated services, especially the in-house insurance brokers.
Yeah, right. Okay, and the final pillar, number four. This one seems to hit the client very directly. Staff remuneration tied to Schedule B fees. First off, what exactly are Schedule B fees?
So Schedule B fees, sometimes called additional service fees, they cover work that's supposedly not included in the standard base management contract fee.
Like what sort of things?
Things like attending tribunal hearings, dealing with complex owner disputes, managing large defect claims, organizing extra meetings outside of the standard ones, stuff that takes significant extra time.
Okay, makes sense that there'd be extra charges for extra work, but the conflict comes from how staff are paid.
Yes. The common practice, highlighted in the report and confirmed by looking at actual job ads, is that the individual strata managers, the staff members handling the day-to-day, are paid a base salary plus a commission based on how much they bill in these Schedule B fees.
So they get paid more if they charge the client more extras.
Directly, yeah. Job ads openly talked about staff earning an extra, say, $40,000 a year, purely from hitting their Schedule B targets. This creates a very explicit financial incentive for the manager to, well, overcharge or perhaps find reasons to provide services that fall under Schedule B over-servicing, essentially.
That's already problematic, but the report mentioned something even more alarming, minimum billing thresholds.
Yes, this was a key finding. Some management firms actually implement minimum targets. We saw examples where a manager had to bill, say, a minimum of $10,000 in Schedule B fees across their portfolio per month just to qualify for their commission bonus.
Wow. So the system itself is demanding they find ways to charge extra just to get paid properly.
It creates a structure that almost mandates prioritizing self-interest. And this gets massively compounded when the strata committee has given the manager delegated authority to approve and pay invoices up to a certain limit without needing specific pre-approval for each one.
So the client, the owner's corporation, ends up paying for extra services, incentivized directly by the manager's personal paycheck, possibly without even getting a chance to review or question the expense beforehand.
That's the risk.
Exactly. Okay. So we've laid out this system that seems riddled with these baked-in institutionalized conflicts. What's really fascinating now is why the current rules, especially around disclosure, which are supposed to protect clients, are failing so spectacularly. You mentioned the transparency illusion.
Yeah, that's the absolute core of why the current system doesn't work. Regulation says disclose the conflict, but the research shows that disclosure is fundamentally sabotaged. Sabotaged by how the information is given, and then crucially, by how we as humans actually process that information.
Okay, how is the information itself presented poorly? What's wrong with the disclosure notices?
Well, multiple things. Often the disclosure is incomprehensible, just buried in dense legalese in a long contract.
Right, impossible to understand.
Or it's overwhelming. Maybe they list 10 different potential conflicts all at once and you just glaze over. Information overload. Or, and this is quite common, it's misleading through strategic framing. They might mention the commission, but phrase it in a way that minimizes its apparent impact.
Downplaying it.
Exactly. And crucially, the sources really hammer this point. Disclosure does not equal consent. Just because you've been told the manager gets an insurance commission doesn't mean you, the client, have actually agreed that this is fair or acceptable. You've just been informed.
It's not an agreement. It's an FYI buried on page 37.
Pretty much. And then the report dives into the cognitive reasons, the sort of psychological barriers that mean this whole disclosure approach is almost doomed to fail for both the owners and the managers.
Okay, let's start with the owner's side. What happens in my brain when I, as an owner, actually read that fine print about the conflict, assuming I even find it and understand it?
Well, owners tend to suffer from what psychologists call the difficulty of judgmental correction. Even if you know your manager has a conflict, say, they get that insurance commission, it's incredibly hard for you to accurately calculate the magnitude of the bias.
Meaning,
how much is this commission actually costing us? How much is it influencing their advice compared to truly independent advice? It's almost impossible for a layperson owner to figure that out precisely. So they tend to underestimate or just ignore it.
Okay, that makes sense. And the second hurdle for the owner was called insinuation anxiety. That sounds intriguing.
Yes, it's such a perfect term for the situation. It basically means owners fear that if they question or reject the manager's advice because of the disclosed conflict, they're implying distrust.
So you don't want to offend the manager you have to work with every day.
Exactly. Owners generally want a smooth, harmonious, functional relationship with the person managing their building. Questioning their advice, especially suggesting it's biased by money, feels like a direct accusation. It's awkward, it's confrontational. So often they just stay silent and accept the advice, even with the disclosed conflict, to avoid that unpleasantness.
So you end up paying a kind of politeness tax, maybe. You're more worried about the awkward conversation than the potential hidden cost.
That's a brilliant way to put it, a politeness tax. Now, flip side. For the managers, the act of disclosing the conflict actually has a perverse psychological effect. It can act as a license to behave more selfishly afterwards.
Wait, hang on. Doing the right thing disclosing makes them behave worse. How does that work?
It's called moral licensing. The thinking goes like this. The manager feels they've done their ethical duty by ticking the box, by disclosing the conflict as required. Psychologically, this can make them feel cleansed or licensed, freeing them up mentally to then provide more biased advice afterward.
Because they feel like, well, I told you. So now the responsibility's on you.
Kind of. I've been transparent. The choice is technically yours now. It reduces their own feeling of responsibility for the bias.
And this links to the other psychological factor for managers, disabling self-interest.
Absolutely. This ties back to remuneration. If the base salary is perceived as too low for the complexity of the job, which it often is in traditional models, the manager starts to rationalize. They feel they're owed the extra income from commissions or Schedule B fees to make the job worthwhile.
So the financial reward, the self-interest, essentially overrides or disables their ethical judgment and their duty to the client.
The anticipated reward shapes the behavior, yes.
Okay, so we have this situation where clients are psychologically hampered in using the disclosed information effectively, and managers are psychologically, almost perversely, licensed by disclosure to provide biased advice. It sounds like a recipe for failure.
It is. And that's precisely why the report argues quite strongly that relying on voluntary reform from within the industry is just unlikely to work.
Why not? Because of competition.
Exactly. Competitive pressures. The industry, as the report sees it, is sort of split into three camps right now. You've got the traditional operators. They're often digging their heels in, actively resisting change, defending the commission model.
Okay, the old guard.
Then you've got the reform-oriented operators. These are the early adopters, the ones who've already moved to more ethical, transparent, fee-for-service models. They're actually using transparency as a competitive advantage, saying, look, we don't take commissions.
Right. And then there's the crucial middle group.
Yes, the transition operators. These are firms that, according to the research, actually acknowledge the problem. They want to change. They want to move away from conflicted remuneration.
What?
But they're afraid. They fear that if they unilaterally give up their commission income and raise their base fees to compensate, they'll just lose business. They'll be undercut by the traditional operators who can advertise a lower upfront fee because it's subsidized by hidden commissions.
So they need everyone to change at the same time, a level playing field.
Exactly. They argue they can't make the leap unless reform is mandated by legislation, forcing everyone to play by the same rules. You can't realistically ask one company to give up potentially 25% of its revenue if its direct competitor down the street doesn't have to.
Which leads to a pretty clear conclusion then. If voluntary change won't work, the only answer is
robust legislative intervention, regulation,
yeah,
to create that level playing field and eliminate the conflicts at their source.
And what are the key sort of non-negotiable recommendations coming out of this research for that legislation?
They're quite comprehensive and direct. First, an outright ban on strata managers and strata insurance brokers receiving commissions. Just get rid of them entirely.
Okay. No more insurance commissions. What else?
Second, prohibiting companies that provide that early stage developer consulting work from then getting the initial management appointment for the same building. Break that link.
Right. Remove that initial conflict.
And third, placing much stricter controls and independent oversight on dealings between managers and their affiliated or in-house service companies. Make those relationships genuinely transparent and ensure competitive tendering happens properly.
So pulling this all together, what does this really mean for the consumer? For you, the strata lot owner who's living with these complexities day in, day out.
Well, the strata management industry is really facing a fundamental choice here. It can try to stick with the status quo with these institutionalized conflicts, but that pretty much guarantees ongoing distrust, more negative media attention, and frankly, erodes any claim to being a true profession.
All right.
Or it can embrace what would be quite disruptive legislative change to actually ensure long-term integrity and rebuild trust. But owners need to understand that PATH likely means higher initial base management fees.
Because managers will have to charge transparently for the work, incorporating the cost that was previously hidden in commissions.
Exactly. Those costs don't just disappear. They have to be covered transparently in the base fee. That, realistically, is the price of integrity in this market.
And that brings us to a really powerful final thought, doesn't it? If all these psychological barriers we've discussed, the difficulty of correction, the insinuation anxiety for owners, the moral licensing for managers if they make effective disclosure practically impossible, then what does that say about the highest duty owed in law? The fiduciary duty, the duty to act solely in the client's best interest. Does that duty actually demand that these conflicts of interest, regardless of their size or whether they're disclosed, must simply be eliminated entirely, not just managed or disclosed, but removed?
It's a fundamental question, isn't it? It really tests who the strat manager is truly working for. Is it the client or is it their own bottom line? Eliminating the conflict might be the only way to guarantee the answer is the client.